Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is conceptual poet Kenneth Goldsmith, who has published 10 collections of poetry and several collections of essays on conceptual writing. He was named the Museum of Modern Art's first poet laureate. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and is the founding editor of the avant-garde archive UbuWeb. Goldsmith's work involves the appropriation of previously written material, as well as the transcription of radio broadcasts. He also writes and edits works about his creative process. His most recent work in that vein is Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in a Digital Age. His 10 collections of poetry include a trilogy of faithfully transcribed radio broadcasts titled Weather, Traffic, and Sports, taken from a New York AM radio broadcast. The Day, a transcription of an entire issue of the New York Times, and his most recent book, Seven Deaths and Disasters, an edited and rearranged transcript of on-air broadcasts of iconic events like the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, the murder of John Lennon, 9/11, and other iconic events. This past spring, Goldsmith caused controversy for reading at Brown University when he read his piece, The Body of Michael Brown, which reordered and edited the autopsy report of the Ferguson, Missouri police shooting victim. Goldsmith will be reading and speaking tonight in a free reading at the Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. It gets underway tonight at 9 o'clock. Kenneth Goldsmith is my guest today. Kenneth Goldsmith, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us. You've described yourself first as an artist. You trained as an artist, then a poet, now a word processor. I think it's a provocative thing you've written, and really there's a lot of that to your work. Describe that process of going to a word processor, if you will.
Well, I was a kind of traditional sculptor and trained as such at the Rhode Island School of Design. And I began making sculptures of books, and they were big wooden plywood constructions, you know, giant books, and books need words on them. And I began putting words on them, and I got so much more interested in the words than I was in the form of the book that I began dropping the structure of the book and becoming a word artist, you know, text artist. Mm-hmm. I was so interested in the words that I stopped being an artist, a visual artist at all. And I figured, well, maybe I can just write because I like the words better than I like making the words visual. And so I began to just sit at home at my kitchen table and punch in things into a computer that somehow I began to think of as being poetry. I wasn't trained as a poet. I know very little about poetry. And then I met the internet in 1993. And I couldn't believe it because the entire thing was cut and pastable. It was a little Unix window, but every word on there could be dragged into your Microsoft Word document. I thought, wow, now I don't even have to type ever again. All I can do is cut and paste and drag things from the internet onto a Word document, and I'm kind of doing the same thing. And so I began to think of my practice as kind of being sculpting with words, word processing, something I'm more comfortable with than sort of poetry.
Do you remember some of the first experiments you did where you were doing the cut and paste?
Well, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, the web in 93 wasn't the internet.
Oh, my gosh. It was a rudimentary thing at this point.
Yeah, it was Gopher Space, which was you'd have to file down, drill down through a series of directories and then drill back up. But what was on Gopher Space in places like The Well in San Francisco, very early BBSs, were all punk culture zines that had been digitized and put up on these bulletin boards with really wonderfully rich language. The language of hardcore and punk, and the whole ethos was there. And so I just began grabbing those wonderful words and those wonderful phrases and arranging them rhythmically on the page.
Even prior to doing your cut and paste work, that was sort of a lot of what you were doing with your own work where you were typing words. You were focusing on a sound or an ending of a word and just kind of going that way, right?
Yeah, so it was really the same thing. So to me, cut and paste is writing. You know, it all seems to be exactly the same. I have no problems with the craft of writing. I think it's a craft in and of itself, but a very different type of craft.
I guess you refer to that as uncreative writing. Is that what you mean by uncreative writing?
Yeah, it is sort of what I mean by uncreative writing. Uncreative writing takes that early internet experience that I had and applies it to the web nearly, you know, over 20 years later. Uncreative writing deals not with single words, but with data sets. You know, imagine that we begin just cutting and pasting data sets, large, big data, manipulating that and representing it as poetry or language, art, or, you know. Mm-hmm.
So when you're cutting and pasting, what is the process of processing that raw material? Are you reading through it? Are you adding to it? Are you changing things? Are you moving things around? What exactly?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I've been through different phases with it. You know, I went through very, very strict appropriative phases where I wouldn't alter anything, you know, and that was very strict and that was very uncreative. And then I kind of got bored of being boring in that way because I was really into being boring and just taking stuff and then representing it as literature. But then, you know, you reach an end to that, and I began manipulating, like, Seven Deaths and Disasters, my book, are radio transcripts, but that's a highly edited piece. I've taken things out. I've rearranged things. And so the process is maybe a post-appropriative process now, and maybe a little bit more creative.
Now, the Seven Deaths and Disasters, how did that idea begin to form in your mind? Were you hearing something in a media situation and said, hey, this could be a project?
Well, just to state it, it's a book of radio transcriptions of very highly public deaths and disasters as they were reported.
Yeah, the JFK assassination.
RFK, Columbine, Space Shuttle Challenger, death of John Lennon, 9/11, the death of Michael Jackson. I might be missing one. I can't remember. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had done a book where I had nothing to do one day on September 1st of 2000. I just didn't know what to write. And the newspaper, the New York Times, was delivered on my stoop. And I just picked up the New York Times and I said, well, what if I just start retyping this entire newspaper? I'm just going to start at the upper left-hand corner and just go straight down. I'm not going to go across the columns. I'll just retype the whole newspaper. And I sat down and I did it. All the ads, there's 300 pages of stock tables. They used to print the stock tables in there. And I spent a year and a half retyping the day's newspaper. And it was really a wonderful way to spend a year and a half. I never had to worry about writer's block. And it was beautiful.
That sounds like a sentence, actually, to some people.
Yeah. It was a project that had a beginning, a process, and then there was certainly going to be an end. So I never really didn't have to worry about anything. It was like on autopilot. But also, like, what the book came out to be was really rather beautiful and interesting, because the newspaper, we never really read the newspaper. We say we read the paper today, but
You glance at a lot of things.
You browse it, which, you know, it's like what we do on the web, too. But this one, I actually read the whole thing. I mean, I read every bit of it. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing, you know, every day. Stories of love, death, triumph, tragedy, war, you know. And then it's pulped and done again another 900 times around the world. I mean, and if you can think of that as literature, and if you can think of all of that ephemeral production, that linguistic production, as being literary, then you say, wow, we live in a really, really rich literary moment. And the web has only gotten more so that way. I see it all as being poetry. I can't distinguish between poetry. As a matter of fact, poetry to me today looks less interesting than my news feed. Mm. Anyway, I finished that project. And when the book was reviewed, everybody thought — the book was reviewed much later — everybody thought that I had actually retyped not September 1st, 2000, but September 11th, 2001. I mean, there was a common error. And I thought, wow, that's a great idea. Why don't I retype September 11th, 2001 newspaper? Not the 12th, the one where you see the planes crashing into the buildings, but the one that people were carrying to work with them that day. And I began retyping that paper, and I noticed, I looked up, and my laptop was drenched in tears. It was really wrenching to retype that paper. I thought, well, this is strange. I'm not doing anything different than I did for the regular newspaper, and yet this one is killing me, you know? And I got interested in that type of emotion, not changing what I do, but what if I turn the camera from something really dull to something really hot, and emotionally hot and politically hot, and I have a whole new way of working. So after I retyped the 9/11 newspaper, I began looking for air checks from 9/11, and there are a lot of them on the web, and I'm listening to them. And these guys are sitting in a studio, and they're just regular guys getting up and going to work in the morning, and they have to describe — they're on the air, and they have to describe that which they never thought they'd have to describe, just sitting there, you know. So it's radio where the media curtain has been torn. It's improvisation. Everybody's off the script. And I thought, wow, this is really amazing, this language that they're using. They're struggling to describe this tragedy.
There was a sense of disbelief having been there that day. There was first a sense of disbelief that, okay, this has to be an accident. This has to be an accident. Of course, when the second plane hit, you knew it wasn't an accident.
And you just sort of went
into mental shock, and yet you're supposed to be able to coherently describe what's going on. It's really an almost impossible task to you almost have to separate yourself from yourself.
But you can't. And so these voices of authority became more like guys speculating on horse racing in a bar. You know, and all sorts of weird things that they would never say in their on-air characters were spilling out. And some of it wasn't really pretty. Some of it was xenophobic and race. A lot of it was very racist. I mean, it was really amazing. And then I thought to myself, well, gee whiz, well, what other things have sounded like? And I went and I found lots of historical air checks. So I've got an air check of Kennedy being assassinated in Dallas. You've seen the footage. You've seen the Zapruder, which is silent. And you may have heard that, but you don't hear something until you read it, until it's displaced from its original form. Then it becomes art. It becomes literature. So that was the way that book came about.
I'm going to go back to the day, which is really interesting because I've read excerpts of the 9/11 day. And it's really weird as the excerpts I read sort of gave you sort of this wonderful foreshadowing, like the weather forecast in the paper. There was actually an article, continued from the first arts page, in which this guy's railing against Islam on the day of this event.
Yeah, it was really creepy. I mean, so much of the day of what happened that day was on the front page of the news. There were things about terrorism. There were things about planes being crashed. There were also stories about, you know, dress codes in school and things like that. But even that became drenched in pathos. Everything, you know, the newspaper was full of things that never happened. Stock market closed for weeks. Ball games that were supposed to be played that afternoon never happened. Movies never ran. I mean, it was really like
Broadway shut down. Yeah,
the end of the world for a while, and all of that was just kind of wrenching to me. Very emotional.
My guest today is Kenneth Goldsmith, a conceptual poet, teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of Seven Deaths and Disasters and Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in a Digital Age, is some of his most recent work. He'll be giving a reading tonight at 9 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to talk a little bit about some of that time when you were directly appropriating radio broadcasts. And again, radio seems to be this theme that goes through you had a radio show for a number of years. What is the intimacy of radio?
Well, I grew up with radio. You know, grew up with AM radio, huge fan of WABC in New York. You know, that was the sound of my childhood. And one day, a friend of mine, who was a musician called Alan Licht, experimental musician, played me a tape loop piece that he did that was taken, the source material was taken from 1010 Wind's weather broadcasts. You know, they do it every 10 minutes. And I heard the sound of AM radio, and I heard the sound of weather in New York, and I'm a New Yorker. I've lived there my whole life. And it sounded like it did 30 years ago. AM radio still has the same sound. It's kind of crackly and trebly and tinny, and I got swept back to my childhood. And I thought to myself, wow, how beautiful. And so I began every day taping the 1010 Winds weather report, which still is broadcast every day, just as it was in the 70s. And I did that for their one-minute broadcast, and I did that every day. And then I would transcribe that, and I put it together. I did that over the course of the year, and I did a book called The Weather, which was just one weather broadcast per day, per year. And it becomes like a classical narrative of the four seasons. I had it divided four seasons, and you see the temperature slowly dropping, and then it pulls back, and there's beautiful talk about the foliage in Central Park. But what happens, oddly enough also, is on the first day of spring, I believe this was 2003, we invaded Iraq. And so for 10 or 15 days in the first day of spring, not only did they give the Central Park weather, but they give the battlefield conditions. So we're hearing about early spring weather in Central Park, and we're also hearing about sandstorms in Baghdad. And then it disappears because, of course, you know, it was presumed that we had won that war, and it was finished in 15 days, and it never comes back again. But it was like, wow, I couldn't have planned that. And again, it is political. It's emotionally difficult to think about what folks were going through then.
You know, and the other thing that's really interesting about it is how the language really hasn't changed in that since we were children. And we're about the same age. And you know, that whole thing of the weather, you know, there might be a little more technical jargon, but really basically that whole idea of telling the weather has not changed forever. And it can take you back to the childhood if you have that sort of ear experience of hearing it as you would have heard it as a child.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. You know, I mean, what could be more eternal than the weather itself? And so how do we talk about the weather differently in a digital age? I don't think we can. You know, it's interesting. I did a reading once from a book that was written by an amateur meteorologist in the 18th century from England. And there was no meteorology. And this guy would just go out into his backyard every day and look at the weather and describe it. And it was very metaphorical, you know, and it was amateur meteorology before that. And there was no language.
Describing the clouds or what exactly?
He was describing the clouds and he would go into reveries about the clouds. I mean, it was really completely beautiful, you know, but it was trying to be scientific, but he couldn't do it because he was just a dude in his backyard.
Well, out of weather came two other projects that are sort of create this sort of trilogy about the sort of things we expect to hear on AM radio. One is traffic and another is sports. And the traffic, I guess, was one day, right?
Yeah. In New York, they broadcast, you know, traffic and they traffic on the ones, right?
Every 24 hours a day.
Yeah, sure. It's New York. It's pretty necessary. Actually, it's not necessary now that we have, you know, Google Maps, Waze and GPSs. I mean, you know, forget it. It's funny, but we used to really depend on that, right. Really depend on that. You'd just be listening in a car. So all it is just one giant kind of static piece of writing. It's just gridlock. Nothing happens. Whenever one bridge frees up, another one starts to get congested. And so it's like a piece of minimalist music, you know, gradually and glacially changing the streets. And, you know, they mention, you know, all the beautiful New York landmarks. I once did a reading of that in California, and a woman came up to me after the reading, and she said, "This piece makes me so homesick for New York." So here it is. Traffic jams are making somebody homesick for New York. You know, it doesn't take very much to elicit an emotion or a memory. And, you know, even something as banal as a traffic jam can take us back to a place that we feel fondly for.
Do you think it has something to do with the fact that it's radio to begin with, which is, I think it's one of the most personal media because you think about it. It's riding in the car with you. It's on your dresser. You know, if you wake up with a radio station, it's in your bedroom. It's a very personal media.
Yeah, it's close, but it's also been displaced now. You know, satellite radio is nowhere. I always miss the sense of locality, you know, and being tied to somewhere regional when I listen to satellite radio. I don't know where they're broadcasting from, and I don't know who they're speaking to. I like really local radio. I like the sound of accents, of local accents. I like the coverage of local things, you know, and to me, that's really what radio does best.
I read I think it was a speech you were giving somewhere where you were talking about authenticity, and you were talking about the fact that now, you know, when you first started doing this, the web was the subversive media, it was the underground. Now, everybody does the web. You want to be, I think you wrote that if you want to be subversive, put it on a page.
Well, yeah.
But you also had this great riff on media and music. And I've always tried to understand why vinyl has come back in such a strange way. I grew up with vinyl, but I don't have any attachment to it because I just remember the pops and clicks after a while. It drove me crazy as a musician. CDs are a great form, but they're also going away. And now it's all in this cloud. And you gave this great reason why LPs are important to us.
Well, I'm not sure I can replicate that because I'm not sure what you're referring to. But I think what's happened is that the web, 15 years ago, we thought we were all going to be digital. But what's happened is we've gotten a sense of our bodies back again, you know, wearable computing, augmented reality, locavore culture has made, the web has enabled locavore culture. So suddenly you can be nowhere and have something really, a marvelous restaurant in the middle of nowhere. And the web has enabled that. You can open up something nowhere and people will know about it. It's a networked culture. And I think that artifacts have become important again to us. And I thought, you know, years ago they said the book was dead, but now books are more beautiful. People love books more than they did before. So I kind of think that it's an integrated moment of so we've got one foot in the digital, but we fortunately, I think in a really nice way, got one foot back on Earth again, too.
Yeah, we might have stepped briefly over and then, and then came back.
Yeah, and I think that we're feeling happy about that. I don't think it's all or nothing. I kind of think that we all thought it was all or nothing. Let's go all that way or nothing. Now I kind of think it's all additive.
Well, I know your comment about LPs were the fact that they were tangible. You could hear them. They weren't perfect necessarily after a while. Something you could hold and actually sort of grab onto.
Well, we used to roll joints in the on LPs, and you'd shake the seeds out back when marijuana had seeds, and you'd shake them out on vinyl. I mean, you know. Meanwhile, you're listening to that record. Oh, they're just so lovely. But CDs, you know, CDs were horrible. Little horrible things of plastic with 2-point type that you couldn't read. Nobody loved CDs. We might have loved the sound, but nobody loved CDs. I don't think anybody was sorry to see those go.
You know, actually, I was picking up a really early CD, like this would have been 81 or maybe 80, you know, really early in CDs. Oh. And actually, when you fold out the insert, it actually folds out into the back of the album cover.
No, it actually looks like it, but it's not. It's cheap and it's horrible. And nobody ever made a good CD box. You know, those pieces of plastic. Nobody ever loved those.
My guest today is Kenneth Goldsmith, a poet who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. His most recent creative work, Seven Deaths and Disasters. And he's also written a book about the process called Uncreative Writing and Managing Language in a Digital Age, as well as written numerous books in the past. Those are his most recent. He'll be giving a reading tonight at 9 o'clock at Terrell Auditorium on the TU campus. What is the reaction to your work in general when, say, you're going to read another of that trilogy was Sports, which actually I think it follows the Yankees in one of their longest games. I think they set the major league, or at least the American League record, for the longest 9-inning game. And, you know, when you read something like that, what is the reaction from audiences?
Well, people really love it. They love that. It's like a child. Why do children love getting books read to them? The human voice hydrates the driest of texts. We love being read to. Almost anything. Read the phone book to somebody in a compelling way. They're going to love it. Sometimes people come up to me and they say, I'm really disappointed. I came wanting to be bored, and you didn't bore me.
Well, you know, the one thing I found interesting about Sports, and I'm wondering if you found this in some of the other things where you did a straight transcription, if you will, like The Day, these wonderful juxtapositions in Sports. You know, it's a baseball broadcast, so these guys are filling time. You know, I mean, the guys are stepping out of the batter's box. They're scratching themselves. They're getting back in. All the things that go along with baseball, they have to fill that airtime, and you'll see these wonderful sort of just, well, I'm just going to go off here for a while. Oh, here's the game. I'm going off here again.
I think it's said that there's in an average baseball game, there's actually 12 minutes of action, of real action, and 2.5 hours of time to fill. And yeah, you know, when you start to examine what that filler language is, it's actually really beautiful and narrative, and people go off into weird stories and fabulous statistics. The way that baseball people compile statistics is just marvelous what they know. And there's, you know, there's on the Yankees station, there's the play-by-play guy, which is John Sterling. And then there's the color announcer named Susan Waldman. It's marvelous to have a woman. And many people do not like her, but many people, you know, but it's marvelous to have that kind of dynamic. And they're really a classic New York broadcasting thing. No, I don't really particularly even happen to be a big sports fan or a big baseball fan, but it seemed to me that it was necessary for a trilogy. I can write about things that I don't care about and still be interested in them because the language itself, the way it's expressed, is nothing but poetry.
And I love the juxtapositions there because it's all of a sudden we're talking about what's going on in the game, or we're talking about something to fill the time while the game is lagging, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's advertising right in the middle.
Well, the great thing about this book, and this is sort of a meta thing, a theme of mine, is it begins, the first line of the book says, this New York Yankees broadcast is owned by New York Yankees and may not be reproduced in any form, with, you know,
without the express written consent. of the New York Yankees
and Major League Baseball. Yeah. And here I am. And then there's an ad for a lawyer. I'm thinking, but I did this. So I broke that rule. And I reproduced it in another form. And I sent it to George Steinbrenner. I sent a copy to the Yankees with the hopes that two things would happen. Either I'd get sued, you know, and make me really famous by George Steinbrenner. That would be great. Or that they would love it so much that every time the Red Sox came to town, like once a year, they would print up 50,000 copies and give it out, you know, give it out as a gift to the things. None of those things happened. I think they looked at it and tossed it in the recycling bin.
My guest today is Kenneth Goldsmith. You can hear him tonight at 9 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus. I want to close by asking about your moment of controversy that happened in the last year, and that was you did an appropriated piece that you reassembled. It was called The Body of Michael Brown, mm-hmm. and you did it at a university reading, and it got quite a – there was a big backlash mm-hmm. against that. What was your reaction to that?
Well, again, it was like after the emotion of Seven Deaths and Disasters and the 9/11 stuff, I wanted to continue down that direction, and I wanted to see if I could turn the heat up on the practice even hotter. Because, you know, I moved from banal and boring to hotter and hotter and hotter. I said, well, yeah, I was very disturbed by the Brown incident. We had been protesting in New York during the week of outrage. I took my two young sons out. We occupied Herald Square and Times Square and every night that week. I was very upset about it, and I thought, I want to address this in the way that I've been addressing other deaths and disasters. This might have been the eighth one. What I didn't realize is that the seven deaths and disasters that I had appropriated, the nation had pretty much settled the way we felt about those. This, we were still unsure of how we were feeling.
It was too raw.
And it taught me a lesson. History is easy. Trying to catch something contemporary in the moment is nearly impossible. And I failed. I tried to do something, and I failed at that. But it was an attempt to, maybe the practice got too hot. What are the limits of my own practice? I think an artist is obliged to explore those limits. And it didn't work. Much of what I do fails. Artists always fail. Our right as artists is to fail. And what you normally see are the successes. But yet, every artist has got a studio full of failures.
That's right. Most of the time, a writer, when they fail, it's a wadded up piece of paper or you know, a deleted file. But this case, this was in public.
This was in public. Since then, you know, I'm listening. I'm learning. And we've seen a string of horrors after the Brown thing. I listen when Black Lives Matter activists speak. When they speak, I listen closely. I learn things I haven't learned before. So after that, my job now is to listen and listen very closely and learn so that I don't make that kind of mistake again.
Kenneth Goldsmith, thank you very much for your time.
This is great. Thanks.
Conceptual poet Kenneth Goldsmith speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent work is titled Seven Deaths and Disasters. He'll be reading and speaking tonight at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the University of Tulsa campus. That reading gets underway at 9 p.m. this evening and is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.